Welcome to From Shadows to Light, a whole human approach to mental health, hosted by Olivia Catchman. This podcast series is centered around a book by the same name. 11 courageous individuals challenge the stigma around mental health and share their wisdom of a multidisciplinary, whole human approach to mental wellness that considers the body, mind, emotions, and spirit of the individual. And now, here's your host, Olivia Catchman, founder of the Phoenix Alchemy and Transformational Guide.
Hi, I'm here with my special guests, Mike and Lisa Adams, who are going to share with you all about their journey individually and as a military family in navigating the impacts of post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. Mike has had a career of 23 years for the Canadian Armed Forces as a member of the Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry, and he's currently a land communication and information system technician. He was officially diagnosed with PTSD in 2006. Mike was actually physically injured in 2006 and sent home to Canada from Afghanistan, but he did not know that he was mentally injured as well. So I'm just going to start with you, Mike. Mike, as you were reintegrating into civilian life in 2006, what were the signs and symptoms that signaled to you that something had changed in you mentally?
That's a great question. It was my reactions to the everyday life here in Canada. I had grown a fondness for anger and social distancing and separation from the things that I loved, like sports, people, social gatherings, going shopping, even for just for groceries. It became evidently quite aware of that there's something wrong, that I just was not reintegrated back to Canadian society and a safe environment.
Right. And, you know, I think that's normal for a lot of people. What were the triggers that set you off the most?
Car alarms, the car backfires, and I hate to say it this way, brown people. And that was like brown people as in the Muslim race. In Afghanistan, we were actually fighting in a war in 2006, still considered a war, and still actively engaging the Taliban, which we kind of just lumped the whole society of Muslim people as a group to that environment. So they were very untrusting in my mind.
Right. I can totally understand that must have been really difficult coming in to really feel that way whenever you saw someone. I'm just curious. There was lots of incidents too, where you had really angry outbursts. What were those triggered by?
In my mind, it was stupid people. It could have been just the most innocent of accidents or interactions. One was like at a restaurant, and the waitress dropped my used silverware on my lap and got like egg yolk on my arm or something, and I just went off. And this poor girl and my wife Lacey kicked me out of the restaurant. She's like, "Yeah, you need to go for a smoke right now." And off I went, and I don't know what happened after that. I kind of blacked out and raged a bit and talked to myself a lot. And that's other incidents were like my anger was, it made road rage look like it was a very tame thing.
Oh, wow.
A lot of it was on the road too. Well, I shouldn't say a lot of it, but there was an equal amount that was equal on the road while driving. So there's no problem engaging people. At the sports diamond, I really still don't play the whole thing out in my head yet because I still can't remember it even from 2006. But I guess an incident happened between a baseball player and I want to say my wife on the diamond. And I came off the bench and I was going out to the field to get this baseball player, and there was no stopping me. And I think the guy, he was afraid, like genuinely afraid for his own life. And I probably would have took it if I could have got to him.
Wow. So this is the kind of thing that would just set you off and set off a series of events where you were just in pure reaction in the moment. And that comes from your training, right?
And it does. You're trained. We're trained in the Canadian Armed Forces for what we call the three block war. So wartime, peace, and then rebuilding the environment that the war was in. So winning the hearts and minds. So we train in those three types of environments, no matter what situation we go to. Afghanistan was the first war since Korea that we were actively engaged in. So it's hard to use Cold War era tactics in a new operationally environment type of war. So we were still learning as we were going and how we would train. The Army has trained and learned much better to this point today. Now they have like Road to Mental Readiness. You have to take that course before you go overseas just to make sure that you're mentally ready and stable and, you know, try to give you the best tools necessary for when you go and then when you come home.
Right. And I know, 2006 was a long time ago. So I'm just curious, since you mentioned that, obviously PTSD was a fairly new diagnosis at the time. How has the Canadian Armed Forces addressed that since? I mean, you're saying that there's this course, but when you come home now, since then, I know you were deployed several times since then. Has the aftercare coming home as somebody from a deployment, has that actually increased in your opinion?
So in 2006, PTSD was pretty much the infancy of PTSD. Previous to that, it was always known as shell shock.
Right.
So now we labeled it in 2005, 2006. And the Army still had the mentality then of, well, if you're mentally broken, then you're useless and then you're no good to us, and then we're just going to ship you off somewhere just to get out of the Army. The Army has then now, today, realized that you're not broken. You're actually just injured. And like any injury, you can start the recovery process, even though you're not, it's no different than surgery on your knee. You're never going to have 100% use of your knee again. PTSD is really no different. You're never going to have 100% use of the non-trauma life. And the Army has harnessed that within themselves. The support factors have grown exponentially. We have mental health services on base. We have clinicians from downtown Edmonton that come to the base a couple days a week on top of the staff that's already here to help with the mass load of mental health stuff. Peer support is getting big. That mentality awesome. Of being broken is gone by the wayside again. And the peer support is the big thing now. For us, it's the Army guys, the hardened Army guys, I should say. We only want to talk to people who have been there.
I can totally get that.
Yeah. So for a clinician in a white jacket to go, yeah, I understand. Well, we'll call out their, excuse the expression, we'll call out their shit and leave.
Absolutely. And I can imagine it just feels like such a slap in the face. If someone's not been there, how could they possibly know what you've been through?
Yeah. And then on the other side, from the government, from the federal government, it's a money thing. To me, it's, if we throw money at you, you'll shut up and you'll go away.
Yeah, that doesn't feel very, very good.
And for a guy to go get help after the Army who is still mentally injured, it's a long process. It's a long waiting process. And then to get in, when you finally get a psychologist or a psychiatrist for meds or the mental health support side, you're going once a month, which is not good at all. I mean, my sessions were taking 3-4 days a week.
Absolutely. Yeah, because it's an intense experience, an intense reintegration for sure. So once a month doesn't even address what you need. So Mike, it sounds like there is money being thrown at this, and that certainly a lot of the stigma has changed over the years with the Canadian military and how they deal with things. And that sounds good, but it sounds like there's still a lot of progress to be made. What would be your top suggestions that would be required in order to move forward and receive better care for post-traumatic stress disorder?
Well, that's a very broad spectrum kind of a question, but I'll give this a shot. So from the member side in the military is actually recognizing that you have a problem and then going to seek help when you see those signs and symptoms. So that's the big step for the military member. For the family member, if you recognize signs and symptoms, don't push the military member. The more you push on the military member that there's a problem and he or she has a problem, the more they're going to push back, and that's how things get squirrely and go sideways and divorces happen. And that's where all the negative condensation comes out of that. For the leadership of the military member who is injured, it is of the utmost importance that the leadership knows their members, so they'll recognize change. You know, if you have a chatty Kathy who doesn't stop talking and telling jokes, and then one day they come in and they're silent, and they're silent multiple days like that, there's a significant change in a person's personality. That's where the leadership has to come in and go, okay, pull that member aside and see what's going on. The military leadership then can enforce a member to go and seek help. That's the great thing about the Army, is that we can do that as leaders. From the public's perspective, not all military guys have PTSD. Just because it's a uniform doesn't mean it's been traumatized. That's a general misconception that a lot of people have, is that when they see a uniform, it's like, oh, that guy's, he's probably mentally unstable, or this is or that's, but I'm going to wave to him because that's the nice thing to do. And a lot of guys, from what I understand and who I know, if people ask the questions, guys will talk. They will share their stories. We're the guys of my generation are the new veterans of the future. And if we go to a Legion and we talk to the vets there, those guys love sharing their stories. And it's no different than our generation now. We love telling our stories. People just don't want to ask the questions. But then comes the other side, is don't ask a question you don't want an answer to. But some dudes don't have a filter and they'll let it out. And I'm one of those guys. I have no filter. And I try really hard a lot of times to bite my tongue and play the political nicety card when I'm talking to people. But then my point's not getting across, and that gets frustrating by me too. So,
well, I know that was a broad question. It sounds like you have a pretty good idea of what needs to change. And I really appreciate you going into a little bit more detail about sort of from a family perspective, a leadership perspective, and just from a public perspective, how to perhaps interact with somebody who potentially has PTSD in the military. Thanks so much, Mike. I'm just going to segue over to Lisa, because obviously as a wife married to someone who is in the military, it's a really different experience. And you're both a dynamic duel. You've been through so much together. And I just really like to get your take, Lisa. At what point did you really notice that all of Mike's new behaviors that were coming home began to affect you personally, as well as your children?
So one of the first triggers that I can recall was when he was home on his HLTA, and we just got married and moved into our new house. And the first or second night we were there, in the middle of the night, a car alarm went off, and he literally rolled underneath the bed looking for his kit to put on because he was triggered because he actually thought it was a rocket attack. That was the first one. And I laughed because I didn't recognize that it was actually a trigger. And then fast forward, the biggest one that I recall would be, you know, going to a Christmas party. And it's in the, I actually write about it in the book briefly, but it's literally seeing your husband being held up against a wall by 15 guys and another guy on the other side of the hallway, about 20 feet away, and my husband's locked on and he's going to kill him with his bare hands. And nobody understood what PTSD was. And when I actually suggested that, you know, to his subordinate or his boss that he had PTSD, he goes, "What's that?" So it was pretty frustrating at that time and really, really scary.
No doubt, because that's like a massive reaction. And how did those behaviors translate in your home environment with your children, Lisa?
So one of the things that happens when we see some of that anger and that show up, Mike's been really good at hiding it at home specifically. There's been times that we've been out driving and the road rage will show up. And of course, our kids would see that. But generally speaking, we've done really well, or he's done really well at keeping it away from our kids. I would see it because obviously I go out and do social things and with him in a different manner. So it would be recognized some of the triggers and that would happen. But we also knew that many times with the hypervigilance, well, I guess initially we didn't know, but we started to take on some of those same traits. So depending on, you know, where Mike liked to sit in a restaurant, all of a sudden when he's not with me, that's where I'm sitting. And the same sort of with our kids. Alex was very hypervigilant about protecting and that sort of thing as well. And he still is. So we realized in that aspect when Mike had a second round of triggers and recognized that he was in a downward spiral and he decided to go get help. We decided to get help for our whole family.
So really that's a case of secondary PTSD for yourself and your children. You're witnessing these behaviors and then at some point you begin to take them on.
Correct. Yeah.
That's correct. Okay. So what kind of therapies did you do, Mike, and also Lisa, that you took on and your children took on when you realized that your entire family really was dealing with PTSD of some sort?
So in 2006, I did what was called direct exposure therapy.
Okay, what's that?
That's where they basically take moments in time from the traumas. So they take you back to a trauma event and you relive that trauma event. So you relive the smells, the heartbeats, how many fast your heart was going, the sweating. You know, I could tell you what temperature it was, what the smell was, what time of day it was, where the wind direction was coming from. So you relive that trauma moment, and they relive all of the trauma moments that you bring up. You relive those. So the ones you don't bring up, you don't relive. And then that was 2006. And that gave me a good base toolbox to get me past that moment or into the next days ahead.
Did you feel that re-traumatized you at all?
No. So I was a witness to an attempted suicide, and that re-traumatized me, re-triggered me, put me into and that was actually a worse downward spiral than I was in 2006. So I was about 2015. And so, yeah, that was the re-triggered event, and I got really, really stuck. I couldn't come out of the triggered event. I was stuck. And so I started a new therapy called cognitive processing therapy. That is how to process. So when you get to that triggered state, how to trigger, why you're there, how you're there. So you do the who, what, when, where, why, how, and you process that whole thing together. And then you do that for every event. It's a long, there's homework and everything included with it. It's another long therapy program, but very, very well put together. And it worked night for me, night and day over what the direct exposure did.
Amazing. Lisa, what kind of therapy did you take on personally that helped you get through some of your emotions and reactions?
So some of the things that I was able to do, as soon as Mike recognized that he needed to go and get other support and therapy in 2015, he got me in contact with a peer support network through the military. And I went there, and I am now actually a volunteer there and have been there for 5 years. But I also was seeing a psychologist as well to work through some of the things that were happening within my life. And what really started to happen when Mike started to get better, that's when my mental health really failed. And I got in my own stuck place. And that's very common when you have a family member that you're supporting and caring for, and then they start to do really well, and you recognize that they're doing well, that gives you permission basically to be able to crash. And then our kids, Lachlan, which is our youngest, he went and seen a psychologist, as well as he did a program through the military called ISTEP. And utilizing both of those strategies, he was able to work through some things. And then Alex went and seen the social worker at the Military Family Resource Center.
Right. And I know you mentioned in your story that you turned a major corner doing equine therapy. Can you go into that a bit?
Sure. So Mike and I actually participated at Camp Praxis and did equine therapy. We flew to Ontario, and the whole purpose of that was for Mike to understand what it's like to with his PTSD for the family. And it was for us to recognize what it's like to be a PTSD person and understand a little bit what's happening with them. But we used the horses to come together to learn how to communicate and to be able to be more aware, because the horses don't lie. They pick up on what emotions and anxiety or feelings that you have. So it was a great way to actually become aware of what was happening with us personally, because we didn't come together until the last day that we were there and worked together as a couple. He worked independently, and then I worked independently, and then we came together. That really changed it for us, because communicating is not my forte. Mike likes to talk through things, and I like to shut down. So most times we get our special word, which we talk about in the book, and he'll use our secret word to see if I'm ready to communicate, whereas normally it's used in the opposite. There's an argument starting to happen and within this family dynamic, and they use the safe word to go, okay, we'll pick this up tomorrow, we'll process what's happening, and then be better prepared for a conversation.
That sounds like such a great tip for so many people, just to actually have these communication tips to be able to know when it's going too much and there needs to be a bit of a timeout, or also just knowing that you need to go deeper and the other person needs to listen.
But being able to process the information, because if you're in that conversation and it starts to get heated or aggressive, by saying that safe word, it gives you an opportunity to recognize, well, you know what, there's behavior starting to come up here. We got to set this aside for now, but we'll schedule a time to come back to it. Yeah.
Awesome. Now, Lisa, I really understand that, you know, dealing with trauma for your entire life, even before you met Mike, has been a huge theme of your life. And obviously meeting Mike has completely changed your perspectives and also the whole direction of your career. Can you go into sort of what that's been like for you to become somebody who helps caregivers, who helps people through trauma? It sounds like an amazing journey you've been on as a person.
Absolutely. So what had happened is 2006, Mike had this diagnosis. We really didn't know any information, but since 2015, and being a peer volunteer with the group that I'm in and stuff, I recognized there was still information that was missing. And I decided at that time to go get my professional PTSD counseling diploma, cognitive behavioral techniques. I'm a holistic healer on top of it. So now I get to really support other people that were in my group initially. And then I decided to help others who've been through traumatic events, and recognizing that there's a lot more people other than first responders, military personnel, who have gone through trauma. And now I get to utilize my skills on a daily basis at Caregivers Alberta as a caregiver advisor and helping with the one-on-one sessions and really building the confidence with those caregivers so that they can better support the care recipients that they're taking care of.
That's amazing. And really, in your work, you've basically found that this is a really invisible injury, isn't it?
It really is. And if we actually even look just to a specific of a caregiver, it's a traumatic event specifically. So then if you add other events that have happened to you, speaking of my own life and different traumatic things that have happened to me, if I don't ever put tools in my toolbox, at some point my cup is going to get full. And then what's going to happen? I'm going to end up in a really mental decline. And we don't know what will happen as I spiral out of control per se. So at least now having knowledge and some skills, I can go back and utilize even myself can be really beneficial. But now I really get to empower other people who may be in the same position that I was and to really be able to support that family. And one of the key things, you know, that Mike and I really try to do is share that knowledge with everybody, because we do understand that trauma affects family, period. Not just the individual, but the whole family.
But if I may.
Of course, go ahead.
The only way PTSD is invisible is if the member is standing there quietly in the corner.
Yes.
Everything you do is visible. So some guys will find their answer at the bottom of a bottle and drink too much, or they find drugs. Or everything we do is physical, outburst, angry, you know,
alcoholism, violence. So
everything we do, then I was really thinking about that word invisible injury, and I don't think it is anymore, because everything we do is physical.
It's invisible to the person if they don't want to see that they have a problem.
Interesting. Absolutely. I see your point, Mike. It is very visible when you know what you're looking for.
And that's why we do these things, and we've written what we've written, because we want to help somebody, whether it's the person that is injured or the family member that is living with an injured person who doesn't know they're injured. So they can look out for signs and symptoms. It's not overlook, you know, if, you know, a person has, you know, a beer day and then tomorrow he has two beers. Oh my God, does he have a problem? No, it's not that. It's, you know, when those become, everything is about booze, everything is about drugs, everything is about anger, everything is about reaction, everything is about screaming, everything, there's obviously something more going on with a person.
I have a curiosity, Mike. My understanding is a lot of people who have been out in service take a variety of drugs, such as antimalarials, that have impacted their lives. Was that something that was part of your experience?
In 2006, we had to take the antimalarial called methoquin. The Army made an order. So the chain of command ordered their members to take this antimalarial drug, methoquin. If the member refused to take it, they were going to be A, charged and not sent on tour, or just not sent on tour together. So come to today, after much research by Dr. Nevin and a lot of medical groups, even in the States, they found that methoquin has a very adverse effect on people. So it's causing scarring in the brain, which portion of the brain, I don't know. I'm not that familiar with. But it's causing scarring and injuries in the brain, almost so significant that it looks like a traumatic brain injury. But some of the signs and symptoms, so some guys are actually diagnosed with PTSD without even having PTSD. They actually just might have methoquin poisoning. And there's interwoven factors of PTSD and methoquin poisoning, or quinism, that they're trying to separate and go, okay, this is methoquin poisoning, and then this is PTSD. And that's what they're doing right now. And like I said, there's guys that are diagnosed with PTSD by registered psychologists that might just have quinism. And Dr. Nevin has all this research and this medical stuff done that proved to the United States Army that methoquin is bad, flat out. So the United States Army has got rid of methoquin out of their whole vocabulary of antimalarial. the Canadian government was like, well, no, it's not that bad. No, it's not that bad. No, it's not that bad. Well, maybe it is that bad. Also, and then one day, all out of the blue, we no longer have methaquin in the Canadian Army. So I go from 2006 when we had to take it because, you know, it's an anti-malarial and you're ordered to take it. And this is what's happening. My tour in 2013 in Afghanistan is like, well, you don't have to take an anti-malarial. I was like, well, isn't there still mosquitoes in Afghanistan? You know, isn't there still carriers? No, it's okay. You don't have to take any anti-malarials. We were at a loss, right? So, and then now in 2016-17, I actually sat in a town hall with a group of veterans who have taken methaquin. And that goes stems back past Afghanistan. That's like Rwanda and Somalia. You know, so previous years. And there's a Moss tort class action lawsuit against the Canadian government put on by these veterans. And, you know, they just want their dues. Like, you know, hey, you poisoned my brain. You injured me. You physically injured me on a medication that was known to injure people. So that's what, kind of where it's at.
It has been recognized that if you have post-traumatic stress disorder, you have the ability to have coping mechanisms and go through therapy and have improvements in your life. And Mike is one of those people in a way, if you look at it. But if you actually have quinism, you're not going to have any positive movement forward within your treatment process because it comes down to the lesions that are on the brain and not specifically the post-traumatic stress or the trauma.
Right. It's more of a physical injury, literally, through these medications.
Right. So you're going to have the same behaviors that you would if you had PTSD, except they're permanent injuries, and there's not going to be any positive momentum forward through your putting more tools in your toolbox and working through processes. You're just not able to do that. And quite frequently, you end up significantly disassociating from everything and everybody.
Right. Mike, did you ever get a diagnosis for quinism?
No.
Not yet.
No. That's a hard medical sell to the Army. A friend of mine put it really well once. He's like, you know, I was in Afghanistan. I had to take methaquin. I never left the wire of a safe place. Never fired a bullet. Never had an interaction with the people of Afghanistan or the Taliban. Why am I so angry? Why am I so hypervigilant? Why am I so this? Why am I so that? Why do I have PTSD? And then come down to it, like, hey, quinism, methaquin poisoning. Same things as PTSD, but just called something different.
Thank you so much for sharing that. That's a devastating aspect of being in service for your country and actually being injured by something that was enforced so vigorously through the chain of command.
Yeah, and that's lack of education, right? So now we have a lessons learned from that, like no different than post-traumatic stress disorder itself. You know, we didn't know much about it. We didn't know how to react to it. We didn't know how to treat it. All we could do is just send the members away so they weren't your problem. And now we're working with those members. We're trying to get them back on the right track, you know, whether it's on a return to work program or ultimately released from the Army, but still with benefits to get help. And we have already gone over how long and stringent that fine for help is already, but it's all in process.
And I think it's important to recognize, and, you know, Mike is a great one to show that from his first treatment and diagnosis in 2006, it's recognized that he can have triggers and he may have to go through therapy again, and that's okay. And I think we'd be remiss to not to mention that, because mental health and mental wellness is not just a straight line. We just don't go from having a mental illness to being perfectly fine and 100%. It's need to be recognized that there can be other triggers or different traumas that can happen, that you may have a slight relapse. But knowing that if you go back into therapy and you seek that help that you need, you can still have forward momentum again.
Absolutely. Well, when we know better, we do better.
Right.
And my therapist put it right the first time in 2006. She's like, you know, you may be better now. It's like PTSD is gone into recession, like cancer. It can go into recession, but it can come back.
So just to kind of bring in some final thoughts and insights. What are your major takeaways? And also, if you were to give a message out to other families dealing with receiving injured military members back and how to best support them, what were your final thoughts be on that?
You said it within the question. It's called support them. Support them, support them, support them. Love them no matter what. If we do have an angry outburst, support it. You know, yeah, you don't have to live through it, but support it. You know, be understanding. If you know your partner or person is injured, it's the recognition of the injury that gets you to that part of support. But for the members who are hurting and still hiding that injury, you know, just know that there is support out there for you. People like me, I may not be on your base or in your city, but information technology is huge and it's easy to reach out. Telephones are quite capable. Reach out to your friends, reach out to other military members, RCMP, police, doesn't matter what line of work you're in. And just reach out. That's, if you don't want to go seek the help and say that you're injured, but you want to talk about something, just reach out.
And one of the things for the family that I just want to touch base with and kind of reiterate is, if you are aware that your loved one has a mental injury, such as post-traumatic stress disorder, and you see those behavioral characteristics show up, it's really important to start to recognize what those triggers are and if they're a conscious trigger or an unconscious trigger. So that's the conscious trigger where you can see the escalation happen, or that unconscious trigger where it's like a light switch moment. And what's really important to recognize is that behavior showing up because of a trigger, or are they just showing up and because they're just being an ass, basically. So if you determine what the two are, you can have a better understanding, because if it's, they're just being a turd, basically, then you recognize that and your response is going to be different. But if you know that they're triggered and they can't process any information for the next 20, 25 minutes, there's no point in engaging into an argument because it's not going to go anywhere. They're not going to remember the conversation anyway. But there's signs that you can also recognize for coping strategies. Some people will shop online. Some people use alcohol. Some use video games. Some just disassociate and like to get away. You know, there's lots of different things that can show up that is not normal for your loved one. And it's just learning to pay attention to that and then really working on you and putting tools in your toolbox to build up your confidence so that you can have a better understanding of what's happening to your loved one, as well as with yourself and your other family members.
That's an amazing way to put it, Lisa. Thank you so much for that insight, because it does feel like it affects everyone. And there's a responsibility, not just if you're married to a military member and experiencing this secondhand, what you need to look for. And do you believe there's education out there for families so that they do know what a trigger looks like versus other behavior?
Well, if they don't, they can always reach out to me and I will share that knowledge with them, to be honest with you. And they can find me quite easily. I think some of the information will be in the book for the contact. But I can definitely help them out. There are some programs that are available. There are some that are in the works as well. So I might be remiss to start talking about a lot of them, but I would definitely encourage them to reach out to me. If they want to know kind of what a conscious trigger and behaviors and stuff are, or an unconscious trigger, I'd be more than happy to educate them on that.
Well, Mike and Lisa, you guys are an amazing couple and you're doing such good work in actually claiming your voices and expressing what your journey has been over the years, how it's evolved, how you communicate even more effectively than ever before, and how you can actually communicate to your community and communities beyond the military families out there to address PTSD in ways that are really effective. So I just want to thank you for doing that. If you want to know more about Mike and Lisa's story, of course, you can check out their chapter in From Shadows to Light, A Whole Human Approach to Mental Health. Thank you so much for joining me today. You both are really inspiring, and I really appreciate the work you're doing.
Thank you so much, Olivia, for letting us be a part of this compilation with you.
Well, it's been a journey, and I wish you all the best in the years ahead together.
Olivia Catchman is here to help serve those who are ready to rise up and feel the freedom of living their fullest potential, a life beyond their wounds. Olivia creates a safe, sacred place and intuitively guides people to let go of their limitations and suffering so they can reclaim their power and rebirth themselves anew. Her offerings include individual and group healing ceremonies, transformational energy work, spiritual dance, and embodiment practices. If you would like to know more, please visit www.phoenixalchemy.net. That's www.phoenixalchemy.net.